Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
So today we're really digging into Telegram Messenger.
Mm.
You know, this is a platform that, well, for a decade really, has built itself as this global safe space, right? For privacy, free speech.
The sanctuary, basically.
Anti-censorship, operating beyond government reach, supposedly.
Exactly. That's the image. But the sources we've looked at for you today, they tell a very different story.
Yeah, completely different. We're talking about revealing not just, you know, theoretical risks, but actual proven vulnerabilities.
Proven vulnerabilities to state leverage and also these massive coordinated influence operations happening right there on the platform.
So our mission today, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
We want to cut through that marketing myth.
Right.
And really synthesize the hard evidence for you. You need to understand exactly how Telegram set up its governance, which is highly centralized.
Yeah.
And its two-tiered security system, how that really paved the way for what happened.
That spectacular, very public compliance shock. Exactly. We're going to show you the mechanics, you know, how sophisticated governments can actually effectively lean on this platform.
And let's just put it out there right at the start. The big finding here is that Telegram is materially vulnerable to state leverage. Full stop.
Yeah.
So we're going to unpack the how and the why. How this platform, which was built on this anti-establishment idea, was basically forced to comply.
Mm-hmm.
And it all tracks back to one single critical point of weakness.
Right. And to understand the coercion, you're first going to understand the control structure. Pavel Durov, the founder, I mean, he holds immense power.
Like almost total control.
Over 95% ownership. And he's the sole person in command. And this is crucial because Telegram, well, doesn't have a formal board of directors.
Here,
nope. All the decision-making power, it rests with him. Just one person. And that concentration, that's the single point of failure we mentioned. It's exactly what states can target when they decide to apply pressure.
And Durov himself, he's always played this game of strategic border hopping, right? What analysts call jurisdictional arbitrage.
That's the term, yeah. Moving himself, moving the company around the globe, basically trying to avoid getting trapped under any single country's laws.
He's got, what, four citizenships now?
Four. Russia, UAE, France, and St. Kitts and Nevis.
Okay.
And the company structure is, well, it's complex. It's headquartered in Dubai. The whole point was trying to make it almost impossible for one government to say, you're under our jurisdiction.
But it's not just about where he lives or where the company's registered, is it? There's a financial angle, too.
Absolutely. It's not just legal maneuvering. It's finance. The company relies heavily on bond sales, not traditional equity investment, but bonds.
How much are we talking?
Around $2.4 billion in outstanding bonds. That's a lot of debt.
$2.4 billion. Wow. Okay, why does that debt load matter when we're talking about state pressure?
Well, it creates another potential lever, right? A secondary pressure point. Those bonds, they're held by huge institutional investors. Think global players like BlackRock, Citadel.
Big names.
Yeah, and even sovereign wealth funds like the UAE's Mubadala. Now, the French action in 2024 didn't directly target the investors, but think about it.
If Durov himself is in serious legal trouble.
Exactly, like long-term jail time, or if the platform's operations were severely disrupted, that could risk a default on all that debt.
Ah, okay. So it puts this sort of unspoken financial pressure in the background. Regulators know it's there, even if they don't use it directly.
Precisely. It amplifies any personal legal pressure they decide to apply.
Okay, so let's get to that pressure point. Here's where, I mean, the theory just becomes shocking reality. We have to talk about the event that basically flipped the script. Pavel Durov's arrest in France, August 2024.
Yeah, this was huge. An unprecedented move, really visible. And it proved just how effective targeting that centralized leadership, that single person, could be.
And the charges were serious.
Right.
Not just some minor infraction.
Extremely serious. He was detained, charged with 12 counts.
Mm.
Things like complicity in child exploitation, drug trafficking. I mean, really heavy stuff.
Wow.
He was released, but on $5 million bail. And crucially, with travel restrictions, he couldn't just leave.
So they pinned him down geographically.
Masterfully placed, yeah. The timing, the location, it was strategically done.
And the impact. The sources show this almost immediate change, what we're calling the compliance shock.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want you listening to hear these numbers because they are just, well, staggering. Telegram's cooperation with French law enforcement basically exploded overnight.
It's hard to even grasp the scale.
Before the arrest, okay, Q1 2024, Telegram accepted just four requests.
Mm.
Four. concerning 17 users in total.
Minimal cooperation, basically nothing.
Then, right after the arrest, Q1 2025, that number jumps to 668 requests accepted, involving 1,425 users.
Let me just repeat that jump. From four requests to 668.
That's a 6,400% increase. 6,400%.
Yeah. The speed, the sheer size of that policy U-turn, it confirms it, right? The second Durov's personal freedom was genuinely on the line, the platform's whole stance on resisting government requests just collapsed.
Wait, okay, 6,400%. That's not like a gradual shift in policy. That sounds like immediate total capitulation.
It really does.
So are we saying the French legal strategy found the one lever hitting him personally that, say, Russia completely missed back in the day?
That's exactly what the evidence suggests. I mean, look back. Russia tried to block Telegram, what was it, 2018 to 2020?
No, I remember that. It didn't really work, did it?
Not at all. They blocked millions of IP addresses, something like 20 million. But users just used VPNs, proxies. They got around it. The technical block was a spectacular failure.
Right.
But the French approach, targeting the owner personally, that worked. It was far, far more effective than trying to block the tech. And it basically set a new kind of terrifying playbook for how states might regulate platforms globally.
Wow. And they didn't try to hide this shift either, did they? They actually changed their public information.
Yeah, quietly but significantly. They removed the language from their FAQ, their frequently asked questions section, the part that used to explicitly say private chats were protected from government requests, gone.
So the underlying philosophy just changed overnight because the CEO got arrested.
Seems that way. And it wasn't just France, either. The cooperation spiked elsewhere, too.
Like in the U.S.?
Yeah, in the U.S., Telegram provided data for over 2,200 users, 2,253 to be exact, from about 900 requests in 2024. Compare that to, well, barely anything before, only about 108 users historically.
So French action kind of broke the dam everywhere.
It certainly looks like it opened the floodgates, yeah.
Okay, so if compliance jumped 6,400%, that leads to the next big question. How are they technically able to comply so easily and so massively? This really gets to the heart of challenging that whole privacy platform brand, looking at the actual architecture.
Right. And we need to be absolutely clear here about what people think Telegram's encryption is versus what it actually is, because this is probably the biggest misunderstanding about the platform.
The encryption myth.
Exactly. Telegram runs a two-tier security system, two different levels, and the default setting, the one most people use for almost everything, that's the weak spot.
Okay, break that down. What are these default chats?
They call them default cloud chats, and this is crucial. This applies to all group chats, all channels, and probably 99% of your normal one-on-one private messages.
So basically everything unless you actively do something different.
Pretty much. And these cloud chats use what's called client-server encryption. The analogy I use is like a safety deposit box at a bank. You put your messages in, you lock the door, you have a key.
But the bank has a master key.
Exactly. Telegram holds the master key to that server-side vault where your messages are stored.
Which means the company itself can decrypt and access all that message content if they're legally forced to.
Absolutely. The keys are stored on their servers. They have the technical capability. And as that 6,400% number shows, when faced with serious legal pressure targeting their leadership, they can and they will use those keys and hand over the content.
Okay, but what about the other tier? The super secure option everyone talks about, the end-to-end encryption.
Ah, yes, the secret chats. These do use proper end-to-end encryption, E2E. That means the cryptographic keys are only on the user's devices, yours and the person you're talking to. Telegram doesn't have the keys.
That sounds much better. So why isn't everyone using that?
Because there are big limitations. First, you have to manually turn them on for every single conversation. It's not the default.
Okay.
Second, they were strictly limited to one-to-one conversations. You cannot have an end-to-end encrypted group chat in Telegram, only pairs.
No secure groups. That's a huge limitation.
Massive. And third, secret chats aren't even available on all versions of the Telegram app, like the web version. Can't use secret chats there.
So realistically, secret chats are only a tiny fraction of what people actually do on Telegram.
A tiny fraction, exactly. The whole platform architecture is clearly built prioritizing convenience, features, cloud sync, not default privacy and security.
And then there's the protocol itself, right? MTProto. That sounds technical, but people raise concerns about it compared to, say, what Signal or WhatsApp use.
Yeah, it's a valid point about trust and scrutiny. Signal and WhatsApp use the Signal protocol. It's open source. It's been rigorously peer-reviewed by cryptographers all over the world for years. People have tried to break it. They've analyzed it deeply.
So it's battle-tested by the global expert community.
Right. Telegram's MT-Proto, though, it's their own proprietary protocol. While they've made parts of it public, it hasn't undergone the same level of sustained, independent, global cryptographic scrutiny.
And have people found issues with it?
There have been academic critiques, yeah.
When?
Researchers have pointed out potential implementation vulnerabilities, things like timing-based attacks that, theoretically at least, could potentially leak information or even recover message content in some scenarios.
So when something isn't heavily peer-reviewed, like the Signal protocol, you're basically just trusting Telegram's internal team got everything absolutely perfect against potentially nation-state level attackers.
That's essentially it. You're relying more on the company's claims than on widespread independent verification. When your goal is rock-solid security against powerful adversaries, you generally want that public scrutiny, not proprietary secrecy.
So all these design choices, making cloud chats the default, not E2E, using their own protocol, limiting secret chats, they all add up.
They all contribute to an architecture that was ultimately vulnerable, an architecture that enabled that massive compliance shift we saw when the legal pressure got intense enough. It prioritized features over fundamental default security.
Okay, let's pivot a bit now. Beyond just compliance with government requests, the sources also confirmed that Telegram is actively being used as a platform for, well, weaponized information, significant coordinated influence operations.
Oh, absolutely. The evidence here is really quite overwhelming, particularly thanks to research from groups like Open Minds Institute and the Atlantic Council's DFR lab.
What do they find specifically?
They identified a massive network over 3,600 automated accounts, specifically 3,634 bots.
Bots spreading propaganda.
Yes, AI-powered bots spreading pro-Russian propaganda. And these aren't just dumb spam bots. They're sophisticated. They were specifically targeting Ukrainian populations, especially in occupied and newly annexed areas.
And the scale of activity was high.
Astonishingly high. The research documented individual bot accounts posting, get this, up to 1,391 comments across 65 different channels in a single day.
One bot, nearly 1,400 comments a day. How is that even possible?
Generative AI. They're using AI to create responses that seem contextually relevant, making them much harder to detect and filter out compared to older, simpler bot networks that just repeated the same lines.
So they're smarter, more adaptive bots.
Exactly. And that sophistication is key. Research from the Max Planck Institute, for example, developed detection methods that could spot these propaganda bots with about 97.6% accuracy.
How did they detect them if they're so sophisticated?
By looking at behavioral patterns, these AI bots tend to respond to specific keywords rather than starting conversations naturally. They often recycle content in tightly coordinated ways across different accounts and channels. They operate like a disciplined machine.
An information war machine, basically, running on Telegram infrastructure.
That's a fair description. And it's exploiting the platform's focus on speed, reach, and relatively lax moderation compared to some other platforms.
And there's another twist here, isn't there? A financial one.
Yeah.
Something about the TON blockchain integration.
Yes, this adds a really troubling dimension. It potentially links this propaganda directly to Telegram's own business model.
How does that work?
Telegram recently integrated its TON cryptocurrency, the Open Network, and rolled out a revenue sharing model for channel owners. Basically, Telegram sells ads in large channels, and they share 50% of that advertising revenue with the channel operators, paid out in TON cryptocurrency.
50% share. Okay, I see where this might be going. What's the conflict?
Well, think about what drives engagement. What gets clicks and views for ads? Often, it's controversial, high conflict, emotionally charged content, like the stuff these propaganda networks are pumping out.
So the more engagement this potentially harmful content gets,
the more ad revenue it generates. And half of that revenue goes back to the channel operator who's hosting it. So the model itself effectively creates a financial incentive for channel operators to host, or at least turn a blind eye to, this high volume, potentially harmful, but very engaging propaganda.
Wow. So the bot farms generate the controversial content that drives engagement, which generates ad revenue, which pays the channel operators, and Telegram itself also gets paid from the ads. It's like a self-feeding loop.
It's a potential self-reinforcing financial loop that fuels the information war, yes. and it creates a structural disincentive for aggressive moderation. Because if Telegram were to aggressively moderate and remove this high engagement controversial content, it would directly reduce the ad views and therefore cut into the revenue being shared via TON.
So the platform is financially incentivized to prioritize engagement, maybe even over-policing the kind of coordinated misuse we're seeing with these bot networks.
That's the concern, yes. The business model could structurally prioritize growth and revenue over tackling these complex information operations effectively.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this all up. What does this mean for you, the listener, maybe someone using Telegram every day?
Well, pulling it all together, the confirmed hypotheses from the sources we've reviewed are pretty stark.
Don't.
One, Telegram is critically vulnerable to state leverage. That's proven now, due to its centralized control under Durov.
Okay.
Two,
oh.
Its default architecture enables potential surveillance at the company level. Because remember, they hold the keys to most chats on their servers. Default cloud chats are not E2V encrypted.
Right, the master key issue.
Right.
And three.
The platform demonstrably hosts significant, sophisticated, and potentially financially incentivized coordinated influence operations. The bot networks are real and active.
So the practical takeaway for someone who cares about privacy.
It's pretty clear. If your personal threat model means you genuinely need robust privacy and security, maybe you're a journalist, an activist dealing with sensitive information, or concerned about state-level adversaries, then the evidence strongly suggests you should be using platforms that offer default end-to-end encryption for all your communications, including group chats.
Like Signal or WhatsApp for its core messaging.
Exactly. Platforms built on protocols like the Signal protocol. Telegram, based on the evidence, has consistently prioritized other things, speed, features, convenience, maybe even its business model, over providing that robust default security against determined state actors. The 2024 compliance data is the proof that vulnerability is real and exploitable.
And thinking about that 2024 event, the arrest, the big lesson here feels like it's about precedent, doesn't it?
Absolutely. For years, governments wrestled with how to deal with platforms like Telegram, technical blocking, like Russia tried. It largely failed.
But France found a different way.
They went after the leader personally, targeted the single point of failure, and it worked spectacularly well.
That French legal action basically established a whole new model, didn't it? A much more effective template for platform regulation.
It did. Using personal liberty, the freedom of the leader, as the ultimate coercive tool. And that leaves us with a really crucial, maybe unsettling question to think about moving forward.
Which is?
What does this precedent mean for how other powerful countries, other jurisdictions, will try to regulate platforms from now on? If Durov's strategy of jurisdictional arbitrage, of hopping between countries, ultimately failed to protect his personal freedom,
then what's the real limit of trying to operate outside traditional legal structures?
Mm-hmm.
Is personal freedom always the final leverage point?
Exactly. That seems to be the new regulatory horizon we're looking at. How far can that personal leverage be pushed? And what does it mean for platforms, users, and free speech online? That's something for all of us to keep thinking about.